This episode features discussions of plotting, violence, and child kidnapping that some may find offensive. Listener discretion is advised, especially for children under 13. July 1874, Germantown, Pennsylvania. The affluent Philadelphia neighborhood had been abuzz all afternoon with the sounds of frolicking children. Nearby churches had held a family picnic, where children had spent the day running rampant until their families called them home for dinner.
Christian Ross's day had been less jovial. He had labored away at his failing business, looking forward to seeing his son's smiling faces when he got home. He hurried down the street and turned the corner to his oversized home, expecting to see his sons playing in the garden. But they were nowhere to be found.
Anxious, Christian split his house servants into search parties. They began to comb the neighborhood, but Christian was stopped by his neighbor, Mary Kidder.
Mary asked, "Are your boys likely to ride with strangers?" It was an odd question. Christian asked why.
Earlier that day, she said, she had seen Walter and Charlie get into a wagon with two strange men.
Christian stared at her, panic rising in his chest. There wasn't a moment to lose. Christian and Mary's husband ran for the Germantown police station.
Well, he was soon relieved to find his five-year-old son, Walter, already waiting for him.
Christian ran to his son and wrangled him into an embrace, but the knot in his stomach tightened. Christian asked, "Walter, where is your brother, Charlie?"
Walter didn't know, other than to say that Charlie was stolen by the man with a pointed nose. This is Hostage on the Parcast Network. I'm Carter Roy. Every Thursday, we tell the stories behind the most captivating hostage situations and the people inside them.
And I'm Irma Blanco. We'll also cover the psychological tactics used in hostage negotiations and what the human brain does when held captive.
At Parcast, we are grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we are doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
And if you enjoy today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you are listening. It really does help. We also now have merchandise. Head to parcast.com/merch for more information.
This is our first episode on the kidnapping of Charlie Ross, the first kidnapping for ransom in United States history to receive major national attention.
On July 1st, 1874, two men abducted 4-year-old Charlie Ross from his front yard in Philadelphia. In the weeks and months that followed, Charlie's father, Christian Ross, would find himself entrenched in a battle for Charlie's life, fighting not only the kidnappers, but the police forces of two major cities to recover his little boy.
This week, we'll meet the men allegedly responsible for this crime, the little boys who were taken, and dive into the abduction itself.
Next week, we'll take a look at the investigation into Charlie's disappearance, the ransom letters that taunted Christian for over a year, and the cacophony of players who fumbled the investigation beyond repair.
The year was 1874. The Civil War had ended only 9 years before, claiming over 620,000 lives. While pro-Union and anti-slavery forces had prevailed, resentment was high on both sides of the Mason-Dixon. America was struggling to recover and move on.
To complicate matters, 3.9 million freed men were now looking for paid work. Racist and anti-competition sentiments blossomed, especially in larger cities.
Even worse, the United States was also recovering from the Panic of 1873, a depression caused in part by the failure of several private banks. Thousands of workers lost their jobs overnight, leading to violent riots across the country, particularly in New York City, where immigrants were arriving en masse.
Yet, despite these difficult times, New York City was still a reflection of 19th century America and everything it could be. A bustling metropolis where any man could make his name and fortune if they were clever enough to get away with it.
Bill Mosier was cleverer than most. Like the Hudson River's own Tom Sawyer, so says Ross kidnapping researcher Kerry Hagen. Born the son of a ship captain and builder in Brooklyn sometime in the 1820s or 30s, he and his older brother Gil had learned the trade of shipbuilding and river pirating hand in hand.
River pirates worked the Hudson Bay, the rivers, and coastlines around New York City, stealing from commercial ships and fencing stolen goods on the black market. There were dozens of gangs that pillaged along the coastlines. According to New York researchers Bert Sugar and C.N. Richardson, Bill Mosier was a bit of an aspiring star in the river pirate trade, hanging around the pirating idols of the time.
Bill loved the thrill and reward of working the river, but Gil learned that he preferred stealing horses and left Bill to ride the rivers alone.
In his 20s, Bill Mosier joined a river pirate gang called the Daybreak Boys, who operated out of the Slaughterhouse Point neighborhood in Manhattan. In just 2 years, from 1850 to 1852, the Daybreak Boys stole over $100,000 in goods and killed at least 20 people. According to Hagen, the victims' bodies were often found floating down by the docks with their pockets turned out.
The Daybreak Boys finally disbanded after two gang members were caught during a robbery and executed by hanging. Bill Mosier was eventually caught too, but escaped his jail cell by cutting through the wall with a piece of metal.
After that, he and his family would use a number of aliases, most notably Henderson.
Over the years, Bill suffered several notable injuries. In his 20s, he dropped a cask on his hand, and his left index finger shriveled to a point. And by his late 30s, the cartilage in his nose had eroded, making it seem like his nose permanently pointed toward the ceiling. It only added to his fierce image as a pirate and thief.
That said, Bill dabbled in honest work when it was available, though woodworking and running a saloon never paid as well as piracy. He tried even harder to go straight after he married his wife, Martha, and she'd given him a little boy.
Well, Bill took to fatherhood surprisingly well. He soon found himself obsessed with his son and tried all the harder to maintain honest work so as to avoid spending time in jail while his son grew up.
But this happy, normal life was not meant to be. When Bill was in his late 30s, his son passed away, presumably of illness. Bill was devastated.
Without money to pay for a funeral, they buried his son's bones in the wall of the saloon where Bill worked. But Bill found he couldn't stand to be in the saloon with his child's bones and soon returned to petty crime. He found work unloading stolen goods in Brooklyn and teaching young boarding house men how to pick pockets.
A criminal school for pirates and thievery, if you will. It was here that he met a new protege, a teenager named Joseph Douglas. Douglas was a skilled pickpocket, took direction well, and reminded Bill of himself as a younger man. Together, Bill and Douglas took to the river as pirates, drifting ashore as far as Baltimore and Philadelphia, slipping into middle-class and affluent homes, and relieving the owners of their finery.
Well, meanwhile, Bill fathered two more sons, who he loved to spoil, and set his once-again pregnant wife up in a rented house in Philadelphia where she could sublet rooms for money. For legal reasons, Martha Mosier ran her boarding house under the name of Martha Henderson.
Even with the boarding house, Bill continued to search for more consistent work. But he was no longer a young man. He was at least in his 40s by the summer of 1874. The average life expectancy for a man at the time was around 49, so he knew it was unlikely that he'd see his sons reach adulthood.
And with another baby on the way, there wasn't time to lose. He needed a big score, something large enough to take care of his much younger wife and his children long after he was gone.
Modern criminal psychologists refer to this call to action, this intense need to score, as the criminal spin, a downward spiral caused by a convergence of life events, desperation, and lack of self-control.
Bill Mosier would soon enter a criminal spin that changed the Ross family and American law forever.
A sweltering heat wave hit Philadelphia in June 1874, driving the men and women of Philadelphia into their homes and their children out into the gardens. Every house Bill and Douglas cased echoed with sounds of summer and children at play.
If fencing and fatherhood had taught Bill Mosier anything, it was that children were a precious commodity. He loved watching them play in the gardens outside their estates. They reminded him of his own beloved sons.
And that's when it dawned on him. Bill would do anything for his kids. Perhaps the wealthy would, too.
Perhaps, he reasoned, ransoming a child would provide his family with the windfall he had been looking for.
It was a simple plan, in theory. He and Douglas would take a wealthy man's child, send a letter demanding a massive ransom, receive payment, and return the kid before the end of summer.
The rewards far outweighed the risks. Even if they were caught, kidnapping was only a misdemeanor, punishable by up to $2,000 and 7 years in jail. And Bill Mosier had escaped jail before.
There was nothing particularly special about the Ross family. According to Hagen, Christian Ross and Sarah Ann Lewis had known each other their entire lives. Christian had been born 10 years before her in 1825, and they lost touch as teenagers, only to meet again when Sarah was 19 and Christian was 29.
The Ross and Lewis families had intermarried for decades, so it was no great surprise when Christian asked Sarah to marry him in 1854. However, he had yet to make his fortune, so the pair waited 9 years for Christian to get a clothing store and a dry goods wholesale store off the ground before marrying in 1863 at the ages of 28 and 38.
They moved into a small house on Washington Lane in the Germantown neighborhood of Philadelphia, where two of Sarah's brothers already lived with their families. Everyone on the street had their own stables and horses. They had covered porches and gates.
Anyone riding by could tell this was a wealthy part of town. Through open windows and unlocked doors, cooks and nurses could be seen working on dinner as the sun began to set.
Between 1863 and 1874, Sarah gave birth to 8 children, 7 of whom survived to childhood. The youngest two were Walter and Charlie.
5-year-old Walter had brown hair, while 4-year-old Charlie had blonde. They both had chubby cheeks and a love of firecrackers. Charlie admired his big brother and followed him everywhere. In the evenings, they played in their yard, waiting for their father to come home from work. They didn't quite know why their mother had left for Atlantic City some weeks before with their 5 older brothers and sisters. They were excited about going to stay with her for the rest of the summer. They told anyone who asked that they were looking forward to a long beach holiday soon.
Although Walter and Charlie's older siblings were away, they never wanted for playmates. Dozens of cousins lived in the houses to either side of theirs. Their extended family owned 3 houses on the block.
They were too young to understand that their family was struggling. They didn't understand that their mother's extended stay in Atlantic City wasn't a holiday, but a chance for her to escape the pressures of her husband's failing business.
Christian's wholesale dry goods company had barely been making ends meet throughout the first half of 1874. The panic of 73 had seen businesses and banks close en masse across Pennsylvania and New York. According to researcher Norman J. Zierold, Christian couldn't afford to be competitive with his prices, and customers simply didn't have the money to spare in his store anymore.
His brother-in-law, Joseph Lewis, was more than happy to help as best he could, but Christian still held out hope that things would turn around on their own. It killed him to be unable to provide for his family. He kept his children dressed in fine clothing and educated by private tutors. He found ways to keep his family's staff oblivious to the fact that it was getting more difficult to pay them.
Every day, his boys followed him to the stables to retrieve his horse and carriage. Every day, he rode the 10 miles to a store and hoped things would improve.
Bill Mosier watched his wife sleep. Her burgeoning belly tented the sheet over her. Any day now would bring a screaming infant into their hearts and crowded home.
Through the thin walls, Bill could hear his sons running up and down the halls. Tenants and those renting rooms for the night were beginning to stir. There were already too many people, and soon there would be more.
He kissed Martha goodbye and left while she was still sleeping. He met up with Joseph Douglas. Today, they would choose the perfect child to kidnap.
Next, Bill and Douglas meet Charlie Ross. Now, back to the story.
By late June 1874, with his wife pregnant and nearly ready to deliver, Bill Mosier knew the time had come to plan and carry out the perfect kidnapping for ransom. All he and his partner Joseph Douglas needed was to pick the right kid.
On the morning of June 27th, Bill went to meet with Joseph Douglas. It was time to act, he told his protege and partner. The affluent Germantown neighborhood would be their hunting grounds. But, he stressed, they couldn't take just anybody, and not today. A screaming child would draw attention faster than a gunshot. Instead, they would befriend the child first, so the next day, the kid might go willingly. It might be hours before anyone would even know they were missing.
Bill and Douglas traveled to a stable on Marriott Lane, just a few blocks from the Ross home. They rented a black wagon and a dark bay horse with a white star on its forehead and a white hind leg. When the men told the horse to giddy up, the animal turned around to them and smiled, a characteristic that would soon become the horse's signature.
A few quick turns brought Bill and Douglas to Washington Lane. They parked the wagon beneath a tree and sat, watching. Bill kept a handkerchief over his deformed nose to avoid frightening the children. Though kids ran freely throughout the neighborhood in little packs, it simply wouldn't do to cull from a herd. The men looked for the children who would be easy to talk to, easy to take without much fuss, the ones who looked and acted rich.
Little Charlie Ross was a quiet boy, gentle. He rarely wailed. Instead, his big brown eyes would fill with tears fit to burst. His lower lip would pout out and quiver. To keep his little blonde ringlets out of his face in the sweltering summer heat, his nurse had found one of his sister's pink ribbons to wrap around his hair every day.
Charlie didn't like strangers. When he met someone he didn't know, he would wrap his right arm over his eyes to hide from them. Once he knew a person, however, his father claimed he was one of the most affectionate lambs you ever knew. Easy to love, easy to care for.
Easy to target. Mosier's eyes landed on Charlie and his brother Walter playing in a yard. He motioned to Douglas, who pulled a long piece of braided candy from his pocket and hopped the wall.
Walter and Charlie looked up at the man. He had red hair and a blonde mustache and wore massive eyeglasses that masked his face. Douglas handed them the candy, which they broke between themselves. Then he backed away and began to ask questions.
Walter didn't notice how quickly the conversation shifted to questions about his father and family. Walter pointed to a massive estate at the top of the lane owned by his uncle and said their family owned that one too.
When Christian Ross came home that night and his son Walter told him of the nice man who had offered him candy, Christian smiled. If you read the newspapers, you might believe the world was getting worse. And yet, here was proof that there were still good fellows in the world, he thought.
Well, the next day, on June 28th, Bill was the one to climb down from the carriage to give Walter and Charlie candy. Bill told the boys not to be afraid. He'd had an accident and hurt his nose. As he dropped the handkerchief, the little boy saw that the cartilage in his nose had eroded. Walter affectionately called it a monkey nose.
Walter asked him if it hurt. Bill reassured them it didn't. He spoke of his own children, who were home with their mother. Walter told Bill that their mother was away on an extended holiday to Atlantic City. They would soon join her.
Later, as they drove away, Bill and Douglas celebrated. The little boys were exactly what the men had hoped to find. Rich, unsupervised, young enough they wouldn't remember details about their kidnappers.
On June 30th, the men came again. This time, Walter and Charlie waved to them the way they waved to their father when he returned from work. Charlie no longer hid behind his arm when they offered him candy. As they rode away from Washington Lane, Bill told Douglas, "We're ready."
July 1st, 1874. Christian kissed his boys goodbye that morning, promising to let them shoot off firecrackers in the yard when he came home that evening.
By 5 p.m., the Ross boys asked their nurses if they could go outside to wait for their father, as they had every day for weeks.
When Bill Mosier and Joseph Douglas pulled their rented carriage up beside the Ross garden wall, they found the little boys waiting for them. Bill had a plan. He knew how he'd get the boys in the carriage.
But as the men offered the boys candy, Charlie took care of the hard part. He asked Bill and Douglas if they would take them into town to buy firecrackers. Their daddy would soon be home and let them set them off.
Bill and Douglas couldn't believe their luck. They motioned for the boys to hop into the wagon. Walter climbed onto the driver's seat between Bill and Douglas. Charlie sat on Bill's lap. As Douglas snapped the reins, the horse turned and smiled at the boys. Walter loved it.
The carriage moseyed slowly up the street without a care in the world. The boys were so comfortable on the laps of the driver and passenger that no less than 6 witnesses would later come forward to say that they had seen them and assumed the boys were where they were supposed to be.
When Bill and Douglas reached Main Street, Walter pointed left toward the general store. Bill and Douglas turned the carriage right. They assured Walter that they were taking them to a special store owned by their Auntie Susie, who would let them fill their pockets full of firecrackers for only 5 cents. Walter was thrilled.
Auntie Susie's store, however, seemed always out of reach. As the carriage turned and turned and turned, Walter asked the men to identify buildings and structures. He hadn't been to this part of the city before. He began listing the names of landmarks Bill and Douglas pointed out. His memory was impressive and disconcerting.
Charlie cooed with worry. He didn't like not knowing where he was. Bill plied him with candy and assured him he would soon have all the firecrackers he could hold. Walter continued asking questions.
Soon, the carriage had driven 5 miles south to Kensington. According to Christian Ross's biography, Bill Mosier told Douglas to pull the carriage up beside a cigar store displaying fireworks in the window. Then he gave Walter a quarter.
Bill told Walter to go buy all the toys and firecrackers he could. The little boy happily climbed down from the carriage and disappeared inside.
The tobacconist usually recognized the neighborhood boys when they came in. This one was new and very young to be out buying firecrackers on his own. Walter placed his quarter on the counter and asked for the biggest firecrackers they had. The tobacconist told him to think about whether he wanted a few big ones or a lot of little ones.
Walter disappeared back outside to discuss it with someone in the carriage. The tobacconist couldn't see who from his seat, but soon enough, the little boy came back in.
Neither heard the wheels begin to turn outside.
As Bill and Douglas guided the wagon away.
Minutes later, Walter emerged onto the street, pockets filled with firecrackers. The wagon was gone. He rushed out into the intersection and screamed for his little brother, confused. He didn't want to be left behind.
He didn't see the carriage anywhere. Had they left him? Walter was usually a tough little boy, but he instantly began to cry.
He went back inside the shop, tears streaking his little face. He sobbed to the cashier, who could barely make out a word of what Walter was saying. Finally, he made out what the boy was trying to say. The men had stolen his brother.
Next, we'll take a look at the hours before America's first ransom letter appeared at Christian Ross's door. Now back to the story.
On July 1st, 1874, Charlie Ross willingly jumped into a carriage with his brother Walter and his 2 kidnappers. The whole affair had been so discreet that not a single soul in Germantown wondered why two children were riding with men who wore handkerchiefs across their faces like bandits.
At 8 p.m. that evening, Christian reunited with Walter outside the Germantown police station, standing hand in hand with a man Christian had never met.
The man's name was Henry Peacock. He had heard Walter screaming outside the cigar store in Kensington. Through Walter's blubbering, Mr. Peacock had sussed out that the little boy lived on Washington Lane and set out to walk him home.
Christian thanked the man and asked if Mr. Peacock had seen his other son. Mr. Peacock paused before answering. Sir, he didn't say anything about another boy.
Christian's heart tightened again. Where was his littlest boy, the four-year-old with giant loving eyes who shied away from strangers? He asked his older son, Walter, where had Charlie gone?
But five-year-old Walter was still too traumatized by his own experience of being lost to give his father an answer. So Christian continued on to the police station located in Germantown's town hall.
It was an imposing building that had fallen into disuse after the Civil War. Now, a dozen police officers used the building as their office and as a makeshift drunk tank.
Christian asked the commanding officer on duty to telegraph Philadelphia's Central Police Department about a missing child. It took 30 minutes for each precinct to reply. No little boy had been found.
Christian pressed again. What else could he do? The commanding officer told Christian to calm down. He was likely worrying for nothing.
Christian balked. He couldn't understand why the police were being so cavalier about a missing little boy. But whether Christian knew it or not, Charlie was far from the only child police were left to deal with.
In Philadelphia in 1874, there were nearly 11,000 street children who roamed the city, picking up odd jobs as newsboys and gophers to earn food money. They slept back to back in alleyways and were shooed away in the morning like stray cats.
At least 3,000 children were documented as factory workers with 10 to 14-hour shifts. If shifts ran long, it wasn't uncommon for children to sleep in the factories or just outside on the street.
There was also a bizarre practice called orphan trains, whereby New York-based charities gathered up homeless and abandoned children, loaded them into train cars, and sent them west, where they might find a home or work.
Although most of these 20,000 orphan train children were taken from orphan homes or jails, or willingly went to escape abusive parents, there were many parents who claimed their children were taken by force or by accident.
Spotty record keeping made it almost impossible to tell where a child was from once they arrived at a new house out west, unless they could remember details about their parents and home back east.
Well, this doesn't necessarily explain why police weren't worried about the life of a child who appeared to be wealthy. To answer that, takes a leap into philosophical anthropology. Historical studies through Boston University, Tulane, and the University of Virginia have explored a theory about the invisibility of children leading up to the 20th century.
It wasn't so much that children were invisible, but rather that they were loved by their families alone and had value in society only once they began to work. Basically, you loved your own children, but didn't worry about the children of others unless they weren't acting like children.
And while kidnappings weren't completely unheard of, police believed they were exceptionally rare. Stranger danger wasn't exactly a pervasive concept, so the officers assumed that Christian Ross was overreacting, that his child would turn up after a day or two.
But Christian was relentless, and eventually, the police officer suggested he take the issue up with Captain William Hines in the central office in the morning. Irritated, Christian returned to Washington Lane, to the big estate on the hill, to visit with his brother-in-law, Joseph Lewis.
Christian asked Joseph what he should do.
Joseph Lewis's counsel was simple and uncomplicated. Christian should go to police headquarters, but not in the morning. Go right now. The time of night was irrelevant. This was a missing four-year-old boy. A four-year-old didn't go places unless people took him there.
Joseph's son, Frank, accompanied Christian downtown to Independence Hall, nearly 12 miles south. They arrived just after 11 p.m.
But Christian was crestfallen to learn that Captain William Hines had already gone home for the night.
And just like the Germantown officer, the central officers told him not to worry. Charlie had probably been picked up by a couple of drunks being funny. They'd eventually drop Charlie off somewhere once they sobered up.
Christian and Frank were dumbfounded. Was that the best the Philadelphia PD could do?
Christian and Frank next headed to Kensington, the area where Walter had been left behind. To Christian's rising dismay, the police in Kensington told him that they had never received a telegraph about a missing child. Moreover, they offered him no help in the search for his son.
Desperate, Charlie and Frank turned to the man who found Walter in the street, Mr. Henry Peacock. They woke him just after midnight, and Peacock graciously accompanied the men around Kensington for 2 hours, answering questions, helping them find their way around the neighborhood.
It was 5 a.m. on July 2nd when Christian and Frank finally returned to Washington Lane. At 7, Christian woke his son and asked him for every detail he could remember.
Walter recounted the details of his journey in the wagon. He described the men who had taken Charlie, the wagon, and the horse that turned to smile at them. Then Christian and Frank returned to the Central Police Department. This time, they met with Captain Hines.
Hines listened to Christian's story, and to Christian's relief, Hines assigned a trusted man to the case. Officer Edwin Joyce took Christian and Frank back to Kensington to meet with Mr. Peacock and search for clues. Before long, Officer Joyce knew something was very wrong.
They found dozens of people who had comforted Walter after he'd been abandoned, and a little girl who had seen the black wagon and the little boy seated on the passenger's lap.
What they could not find was the route the wagon had taken after leaving Kensington. The little girl had noticed them heading east, but no one in that direction had paid any attention to where the wagon was headed.
Officer Joyce returned with Christian to his home on Washington Lane and asked Walter if he remembered the path the wagon had taken.
As the men drove the carriage, Walter called out directions. In a few minutes, they had arrived back to the cigar shop in Kensington. They had taken 18 turns along the way, far more than were necessary. Officer Joyce told Christian he suspected his child had been deliberately taken, that the kidnappers had targeted the little boys, believing they were too young to remember anything about them or the route they took. When they realized Walter was too clever, they abandoned him.
Officer Joyce turned the carriage around and followed the route back, asking people along the way if they had seen a black wagon the day before. The route was littered with eyewitnesses. Stable boys, clerks, and hotel workers all recalled seeing two boys in a black wagon with two men wearing handkerchiefs across their faces.
Unsure of what next to do, Christian reached out to the Public Ledger, a local and well-circulated newspaper. He placed an ad in the Lost and Found section, offering a substantial reward for the return of a four-year-old boy with light curly hair.
Already on thin ice with his wife, Sarah, Christian used Officer Joyce's name to place the ad in an attempt to avoid her seeing the news in the newspaper before he had a chance to speak with her. For the same reason, Christian didn't include a picture or Charlie's name.
Social science research conducted at the University of Massachusetts has found that humans lie about as often as they sneeze or yawn. That is to say, on average, several times daily. The reasons are varied, but two of the biggest reasons are to cover up mistakes or misbehavior and to avoid hurting the ones we love.
The reality, of course, is that had he included a picture of his son in the ad, the entire city would have been on the lookout for his little boy by the next morning. But his pride cost him valuable time in locating his missing child.
As a storm rolled in over the city, there was nothing more to do on July 2nd but return home. Christian and Walter's families and friends gathered to pray for Charlie's return. Many suggested Charlie had been taken for ransom.
The thought relieved Christian a little bit. If that were true, then the men who had taken Charlie might see his lost and found ad and respond, and this whole thing could be over before his wife found out.
The ad soon confirmed his family's suspicions. Four different witnesses along Washington Lane came forward to tell him that they had seen men offering his sons candy at least 4 days before Charlie's abduction. Two had even seen the boys get into the wagon willingly.
Christian took the information to the Central Police Department at Independence Hall. When he arrived, Captain Hines funneled him into a room where several detectives were waiting to hear his story. The district attorney, the chief of police, and the mayor of Philadelphia, William S. Stokely, came in to listen as well.
Christian told them everything he knew, relief washing over him. If anyone could bring his son home, it had to be the men assembled in this room. There was a quiet pause as the men glanced between each other. Then the mayor asked Christian, "What do you think our next course of action should be?"
Christian was flummoxed. Surely the police must know what to do. They probably dealt with this sort of thing all the time. How could they need his input to find his missing son?
Christian was right to worry. At that point in America's infancy, police weren't trained the way they are today. To become an officer, a man only needed the recommendation of someone who was already on the force.
In a way, police departments were like men's clubs with the authority to make arrests, and it wasn't uncommon for criminals to bribe their way out of sticky situations or for gangs to get one of their own appointed as a police officer to protect the rest of the mob.
Police forces were called forces for a reason. Strong-arm officers patrolled city streets in groups, carrying wooden clubs. Because of their assumed authority, they quickly became thugs in their own right, beating people for small infractions and assaulting women who walked home alone from work. Law enforcement was lawless.
For this reason, citizens often turned to private detective agencies to solve crimes instead, because they had more training.
According to Professor Roger Lane, among others, affluent and poor neighborhoods alike preferred to organize neighborhood watches instead of relying on police, leading to competition, animosity, and a lack of organization when serious crimes were committed.
But Christian Ross no longer had the means to hire a private detective. And as a man raised in the upper crust, he might not have fully understood the shortcomings of the police force. So, baffled, he told the men to track down the horse and wagon used to kidnap his son. If they could find the wagon, they could identify the men who had him.
It seemed like a simple course of action, but the police couldn't be trusted with the task. By the end of that day, July 3rd, the Philadelphia Police Department would destroy two Roma camps while chasing down leads after hearing an unsubstantiated rumor that a group of Roma were keeping a blonde boy hostage.
Police beat the men in the camps fiercely, only to discover that the blonde boy hostage was in fact the daughter of one of the men they had beaten.
Christian realized he couldn't rely merely on police if he hoped to see his son again.
48 hours after Charlie Ross had disappeared, Christian placed a second lost and found ad in the public ledger.
On July 4th, as the rest of the city celebrated America's independence, Christian waited for news of his son. When news finally came, it chilled him. A ransom letter had arrived at his brother-in-law's store, addressed to him, smeared with ink blots and riddled with terrible grammar.
There was no doubt that it must be from the men who had Charlie. In the very first sentence, the kidnappers had identified the little boy using his middle name. It read, quote, "Be not uneasy. Your son, Charlie Brewster, be all right. We has got him, and no powers on earth can deliver out of our hand. You will have to pay us before you get him from us," end quote.
The letter went on to warn that any interference from police, any attempt to find where they had hidden Charlie, would cost the little boy his life.
As Christian raced back to the police station at Independence Hall with the ransom letter in hand, he had no way of knowing that the wheels of bureaucracy were already turning against him.
That at that very moment, he was running for help from the very men who might cost Charlie Ross his life. Next week on Hostage, we'll take a look at the firestorm that erupted as ransom letters began pouring in for Charlie Ross.
We'll also look at the obstacles Christian faced from police and the Philadelphia bureaucratic machine as they tried to track down the men who had taken his son.
Thanks again for tuning in to Hostage. We will be back Thursday with a new episode.
You can find more episodes of Hostage, as well as all of Parcast's other podcasts, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play, or your favorite podcast directory.
Several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. We'll see you next time.
In the meantime, don't take your freedom for granted. Hostage was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound designed by Dick Schroeder, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro and Paul Mahler. Additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Freddie Beckley. Hostage is written by Jordan Trapier and stars Irma Blanco and Carter Roy.